one radical ex-student shot at Alexander II as he was emerging from a stroll in the summer garden in St. Petersburg. The student's name was Dmitry Karakazov, and he was a member of a Petersburg organization with the rather fanciful name of Hell. He missed, but he was captured immediately, and he was executed shortly after, becoming for many young Russians a martyr to the cause. To many peasants, a sign of the criminal activity among the urban elite, as they saw it. In the years that followed, in fact, there would be many such attempts on the life of the Tsar, many of them, unlike Karakazov's, not with pistols but with bombs. It was seen much more appropriate to blow the Tsar up than merely to shoot at him. And, of course, as you know, one would finally succeed in 1881. The result, though, as is often the case with terrorist acts, was not, of course, to inspire revolution among the people. Indeed, sympathy for the targeted monarchy tended to grow, and contempt for the revolutionaries grew as well. And what motivated these young Russians? What were they trying to achieve? There's no real simple or easy answer here. For some of them, it was a sort of vague sense of anger about life in Russia, and about their own lives, about the poverty of the peasants, about the many limitations that still existed on freedom, about the inadequacies of the great reforms as these began to emerge, about the backwardness of their society, the same sort of embarrassment that intellectuals had often felt before. For some, quite frankly, it was about excitement. It was about thrills. Many of these young students were not as high-minded as the intelligentsia of Herzen or Belinsky's generation. But many had very concrete ideas, very concrete goals about what they were trying to achieve, shaped by reading, just as it was for Herzen and Belinsky and his generation, but also by the growth of a liberal movement, liberal ideas, and even by the state's own efforts at reform. One way of getting at what these ideas were is to look at some of the publications, the manifestos, the pamphlets, all, of course, produced illegally, that appeared, especially in 1861, 1862, a great high point of that movement in the very wake of the first great reform, the ending of serfdom. These are very different, but I want to mention a couple of them to give you an idea of the type of ideas that were inspiring these students. For example, a relatively moderate brochure, really more of a manifesto, one best described as essentially liberal, was one that went under the name of Great Russia. This called for wider reforms than were being planned, it appeared, by Alexander II. In particular, it called for creating an elected legislature with legislative powers. In other words, what increasingly would be called crowning the edifice of the great reforms. It called for a true constitution, which would, as they said in this manifesto, allow the government to be in touch with the living forces of the country, a popular phrase meant to indicate the sense among many educated Russians and certainly these students that there was a civic life that was increasingly alive, full of ideas, kept out of having any influence over the way the state was run. And finally, something that was becoming increasingly important to many of these young protesters, freedom for Poland. Everything about Russian imperialism offended them, but control over Poland, which really was created in Catherine the Great's time, was the most troubling. Here was a clearly independent country, or a country of its own, a nation with its own language, that was ruled like a colony. Not only that, the Polish movement of independence was strong and was about not only national independence, but also civil liberties, and they supported this. Another example, a more radical one, was called to the young generation, and note the focus on the young. The old aren't to be talked to anymore. They won't understand. This was written by students, and it was printed, interestingly enough, by a member of the old generation, by Herzen in London. Hence, it could be printed in large numbers and circulated. In fact, the group of students who went to see Herzen later recalled going to him just like a Muslim's pilgrimage to Mecca. They had felt they had gone to the heart of the history of the intelligentsia, to the sanctuary of the prophet. They smuggled these back to Russia in the summer of 1861, and these were distributed by students. And the message was simple but vague. The only vital forces in the country were peasants, the intelligentsia, and especially young students. In other words, not, notice, the traditional leading estates in the country, not the nobles and not the clergy. Monarchy was absolutely unnecessary, and it should be replaced by a republic based in a peculiar way that was never quite explained on peasant communes. Like the Slavophiles, they admired this natural communalism of the Russian people. And in fact, they argued the whole economy should be created as some vaguely defined socialist economy based on cooperatives everywhere, rural and urban cooperatives. An even more radical manifesto was one called Young Russia. Again, the focus on youth. It came out in 1862, and it was written by a student who'd been expelled from Moscow University, a guy named Pyotr Zaychnevsky. Politically, this called for Russia to be a decentralized federation, virtually no state whatsoever. Economically, the country should be run on the basis of self-governing communes. Also, there should be free education. It wasn't clear who would pay for that, since the state was to be rather minimal. Absolute equality for women, and the right of all nationalities to simply leave the Russian Empire and be free. Really interesting about this petition, about this manifesto, though, were the methods proposed. Something about the intensity, the extremism of this movement. It was declared that peasants would destroy the old order in Russia in a violent uprising. And that was their goal, to inspire peasants to rise up and exterminate the old order. And this violence that they talked about was not simply necessary, but it began to be treated, at least in this manifesto, as glorious. Unlike most leaflets of the period, which warned, if you don't improve conditions, those peasants are going to rise up and there will be a bloody conflagration that needs to be avoided. This one said, no, on the contrary. It treated it as a good thing to be looked forward to. It reveled, this manifesto, in imagining such violence. It described in great detail rivers of blood that will flow down the streets and the villages. It described peasants destroying, but it also noted that only militant and conscious intellectuals could build the new order, could make sure that all the old ways were removed. And the manifesto called for the creation of a dictatorship of elites who would, as they put it, stop at nothing. All of this, you can probably see, are echoes of Jacobin radicalism from France of 1792 and after, which was well known to them. Now, proclamations that were this extreme actually alienated many liberals. Even people, old radicals like Herzen himself, found this extreme sort of statement to be really too much. These fears of the radical movement were, in fact, reinforced by a series of suspicious fires that broke out in Petersburg in the summer of 1862. Many felt radical students had probably set these fires, and many considered one man to be to blame, 34-year-old writer named Nikolai Chernyshevsky, editor of the most leading radical journal of the day, The Contemporary, that was allowed to publish legally, and surprising how much was allowed, but an indication of the liberalized censorship rules, at least at this point. And many suggest that if he either was the inspirer of these actions, of these radicalism, and of these fires, or at least, if not directly in charge. Hoping to stop the movement, the government actually arrested Chernyshevsky in July of 1862, sentenced him to 7 years in prison and a lifetime of exile to Siberia, where he died shortly after returning, a few months before after returning in 1889. It's worth trying to understand something about Chernyshevsky's ideas, because they tell us something about what was inspiring students. They all read Chernyshevsky. Concretely, he had the usual list of popular ideals: communal economic reforms, emancipation and equality of women, complete civil rights, democratic government, and the like. But even more telling and more influential were his philosophical ideas, which were called by him rational egoism. Though in fact, these ideas in many ways were drawn on his reading of European philosophers. This time, the choice was the utilitarians, especially Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill. It was egoism in the sense that what was most important in the world, he said, were individual needs, individual happiness. This has to be the basis of all morality. But it was rational egoism, he argued, and many were influenced by this, by the notion that one's self-interest, one's egoism, truly lies in seeing the greatest benefit among the largest number of people. You're an egoist? Everybody's an egoist. And to respect their own individual needs and rights was essential to creating a happy world. Concretely, this means your self-interest lies in the well-being of all people. And then, he argued, elaborating beyond the European utilitarians, an egoist understands that his real interests lie in cooperation and therefore in socialism. This all led to a logical argument for socialism. Not the most brilliant set of philosophical ideas, but still very compelling because it seemed scientific. And this is an important aspect of this. On the one hand, you can see he places the individual at the center of his arguments, just as Herzen and Belinsky did, and advocates socialism as they did on this basis. But he packages these ideas as rational and scientific. And this was very much part of the spirit of his age. This was, after all, the age of Darwin. Origin of the Species was published in 1859 and widely read. Karl Marx was arguing for scientific socialism in these years. But I'd suggest you at least question how scientific these ideas were, though the packaging was part of its appeal. Science made these ideas seem true and legitimate. Karl Marx was making the same sort of arguments about socialism, that he had put it on a scientific basis. But one could ask about Marx, for example, was the idea of cooperation, was the ideal of justice really just science? Or was it a dream born of moral idealism wrapped in a scientific cloak? And I think one could ask the same question about Chernyshevsky. Was it really rational and egotistic or scientific to talk, as he often did in his writings, about creating a society based on love, about dreams of happiness, which he often wrote about, most famously in his influential novel, written while in prison, called What Is to Be Done? In many ways, one might argue that Chernyshevsky and the students who embraced these ideas were inspired by science, but also, maybe even more deeply, by a sense of what they would call justice, by a moral vision. Now, these ideas of this talk about radical ideas is useful, as is talking about their programs, for understanding this troubling student movement. But I think one can go at least a little bit deeper by presenting a few images. And I don't mean literally pictures, but images of their style, of their manner, of their behavior. One might say their way of performing their ideas. I think this tells us a little more about what they had in mind. Image one, the appearance of the classical nihilist, these radicals who seem to deny all tradition and all traditional institutions and faith. According to observers who observe these nihilist students, a man would be typically seen wearing a red work shirt, even if he was a nobleman, dark glasses, long hair, and dirty fingernails. Generally, the point was to look sloppy and plain, no matter what your class. Women, and here I quote from a report on the student movement by the head of the Tsarist secret police in 1869, that reports that a typical young female student, radical, and he writes this with obvious disgust, went around in public with short hair, blue-tinted glasses, sloppy dress, uncombed and unwashed, and lived in the company of a similarly repulsive individual of the male sex, or with several of them. Image two, consider their manners, again in the eyes of contemporaries. Here's an 1864 description of a female student nihilist, a nihilistka, as they like to call them. She was described as having curt and awkward manners. In general, it was said these nihilist women despise art, beauty for its own sake, use ty, the informal you, with several young men, seen as quite immodest and racy, light their cigarettes not from a candle, that was considered proper, but from men who smoke and are uninhibited in their use of expressions. Or image three, something about lifestyle. It's notable that many of these, as I mentioned briefly, many of these young people set up communes with complete equality between classes and genders, at least in theory, absolute equal responsibilities, who should cook, who should clean, and also part of the style of the times, part of the lifestyle of the times, what they called already free love. An individual should be free in whom he wants to feel romantic toward, with whom even to engage in sex. There should be complete freedom and equality in all senses. Now, in reality, things were not often what they seemed or what they dreamed of. Most communes failed within a very short period of time. The members tended to quarrel. For example, when a richer member of a commune would bring in a maid, when it was his day to do a cleaning. And also, free love, which was always accepted as a principle, in reality often led to great feelings of betrayal and jealousy. Few communes survived. But these realities don't take away from what these young idealists were trying to do. It seems that to me that the purpose of all this radical style, and some of it is really a type of youthful playing, to be sure, what they were trying to achieve, I think, is clear. They were trying to follow a famous piece of advice offered by Chernyshevsky in one of his writings. As he put it, bring what you can from the future into your present life. Or to use another phrase made famous by Chernyshevsky, in fact the subject of his novel, What is to be Done, try to be new people. Live in a way that suggests what it is you're trying to create. One can suggest, by the way, that this idea of being new people, creating the life that you want to dream of, is not just about science or rationalism or egoism. However foolish and often dangerous it sometimes seems, there was a kernel of true idealism here. Next time, I want to continue this story into the last decades of the 19th century, and particularly focus on something really new and would be of enormous consequence for later Russian history, the rise of Marxism.
Lecture 15, Populists and Marxists.
By the 1870s, among large numbers of educated Russians, nihilism, which I talked about last time, as it was called, of course, by its critics, began to give way to what was called, though often with no less contempt, populism, or народничество. And this, in turn, by the 1880s and 1890s, began to be replaced increasingly by Marxism. And this is the subject of this lecture. In a lot of ways, populism became, from the 1870s all the way into the 1880s and early 90s even, the dominant way of thinking about politics and society among people who saw themselves to be on the Russian left. And in fact, in a lot of ways, populism remained influential even up to the 1917 revolution and beyond. In fact, even many liberals were in some ways influenced by populist ideas. I should also say that the popularity of these ideas, as well as of liberalism, was one of the many signs in Russia of a deepening, continuing, of a problem that had been emerging for the last couple of decades, namely what has been called the parting of ways between educated society and the monarchical state. On the one hand, widespread desires for democracy and civil rights and social justice, ranging from liberal positions to quite radical socialist, even anarchist arguments. And on the other hand, a state that was still wedded to ideas of the necessary and sacred authority of Russian autocracy, of Russian monarchy. So what was Russian populism? The standard definition, not necessarily the best, runs about as follows. Populists, as their name suggests, were devoted to serving the people. The more moderate populists were determined to try to improve their immediate lives, and this was the type of populism most influential among many liberals, especially those associated with the zemstvos, these organizations of local administration, rural self-government, set up in the great reforms. More radical populists wanted to serve the people in a more extreme way by organizing them for revolution. Secondly, as part of this standard definition of populism, the argument is that capitalism, which was increasingly visible in Russia after the abolition of serfdom and the growth of a more modern economy, capitalism, they argued, would not improve the lives of ordinary Russians. Only socialism would. Third, they believed that Russia had a rather unique opportunity, a historical opportunity to avoid the evils of capitalism, which were seen as necessary and logical to modernization in other countries, but Russia didn't need it and could bypass it through the peasant commune with its existing traditions of collective work and collective ownership. You hear here, of course, an echo of the earlier Slavophiles. And finally, populists tended to focus above all and increasingly on the social dimensions of revolution. Political changes were important, but really secondary. It was said what really had to happen first in Russia was transform society, transform social and economic relations. Now, all this is accurate, but it's superficial to really say that this captures the essence of populism. To probe a little more deeply, I want to suggest that we look at some of the leading populist thinkers. Before, though, considering their ideas, it's useful to take notice of the remarkable power that these ideas, indeed that ideas at all, continue to have for educated Russians. Listen, for example, to this recollection about the impact of one of the most influential works in those years, a work called The Historical Letters, written by a leading populist philosopher, Pyotr Lavrov. It was published in 1869-70, again a case in which the censor didn't, even after the fact, completely understand what was at stake here. "Oh," this person wrote, "you just had to live in the 70s to see around you and feel within you the astonishing effect produced by the historical letters. Many of us, youths at the time, never parted with that tattered little book. We read it and reread it until it finally wore out. It lay under our pillows, and as we read it at night, hot tears of idealistic enthusiasm fell upon it, an enthusiasm that gripped us with a boundless desire to live for noble ideas and even to die for them." You can hear the echoes of this whole tradition of intelligentsia passion here. But what were the particular ideas that brought these young Russians to such raptures? First of all, like so many before them, notably Belinsky, who we've talked about, Lavrov expressed his dissatisfaction with the man who was still the most popular European philosopher of the day, in Russia anyway, Hegel. The problem with Hegel, he said, was there's a lack of any practical philosophy. In particular, Lavrov argued, there's no morality to guide action. And it was action, not words, that Russians, young Russians, in the 1870s, increasingly desired. Secondly, also like many before Lavrov, in Europe as well as in Russia, Lavrov articulated what he considered to be the proper center of any practical philosophy. And that was a principle we've heard before, the idea of lichnost, this Russian word that indicated the individual human being, the personality, the self. And Lavrov argued, as many did at the time and before, the need to judge all social relationships, all political relationships, by how they affected actual living human individuals. And of course, to seek a social order and a political order that would better promote individual welfare. But he also went further, and he argued in a way that was very influential at the time, that people he called critically thinking individuals, people capable of understanding these moral and political principles, of understanding the world around them, had a duty, had a moral duty to act on behalf of society as a whole, of the people who couldn't understand all of these things. Educated people in particular, who received their education in a certain sense at the cost of the poverty in the country, because they were not poor, but their wealth, their prosperity, even the little bit of money it took to go to university, came at somebody's cost. They therefore owed a debt to the rest of the country, to the majority. Third, there's a further innovation here in these ideas, especially in Lavrov's ideas. Namely, in a certain sense, one might say that Lavrov added Kant to this intellectual stew, this sort of intellectual borscht, one might say, of Russian ideas, of European ideas that were so attractive and so influential and inspiring in Russia. Lavrov rejected materialism and utilitarianism for one thing. He was totally uninterested in these scientific rationalist ideas of the 1860s, as many in the 70s also were, and went back in a certain sense to Kant's moral notions. Like Kant, Lavrov insisted on the existence of moral truths, absolute, universal moral truths. These were not transcendental ones in the sense that they were given by God. Lavrov, like many thinkers of the time, did not rely on religion as a source of truth. But these were moral truths that emerged from the very nature of the human being, from the natural inclinations of the human consciousness, or one might say in Russian, emerged from Lichnost. Just thinking about what the human being is and the nature of the human being will lead you to moral truth. And what were these moral truths? First and foremost, the familiar idea of personal dignity rooted in natural human equality. And secondly, elaborated much more now than in earlier years, the idea of justice. And for Lavrov, of course, and for many in his time, justice meant the recognition that one's own personality and its needs and the personality of another. And recognizing that these both require respect and the opportunity to develop. Something was completely lacking in Russia. You can see this is a continuation and elaboration with some new European elements, some new formulations of ideas that were truly becoming traditional in the way educated Russians critique their society. There are a number of other popular texts besides Lavrov's historical letters that tell you something about how these populists were thinking. And they too, in a way, emphasize this lack of respect for the dignity and justice of people that existed in Russia. For example, a work by a man named Bervy Florovsky called The Condition of the Working Class in Russia was published in 1869. And again, the censorship reform allowed many of these to be published where they wouldn't have been in earlier years. And this was a book that was not about working class in the way it was understood in later times or even in Europe. It was about peasants, the class of people in Russia who worked. And what really impressed people was its unprecedentedly clear description of how much peasants, and to some extent the small class of urban workers, suffered in Russia. Another influential work by a man named Nikolai Mikhailovsky, a book called What is Progress? That came out in 1870. Here it was a description of capitalist progress in Europe, and it tried to show that such progress, such as capitalism brought, was not good. It was in fact retrograde. The division of labor, characterized by a modern economy, meant that people lost touch with their whole being, with their selves. And real progress had to advance human self-realization. Capitalism, he argued, didn't do that. This particular message, in fact, was reinforced in 1872 by the publication in Russia, the first volume of Karl Marx's huge economic study, Capital, that was translated into Russian by two populists. What's interesting, though, is what impressed people about reading Marx, in fact, one might say, where they misunderstood him entirely. It wasn't Marx's arguments about how capitalism was necessary for progress, something Marx actually does argue in Capital and in other works. What really they liked about this book was how it showed suffering. It showed the suffering of workers. In other words, what really appealed to them was not the analytical message of capital, but its moral message. People suffer in Western Europe because of capitalism. Now, you can probably see that none of these works are placing real emphasis on the thing that's said to traditionally have defined populism, a socialist society based on a peasant commune. Partly this is due to censorship. One couldn't explicitly make such an argument. But in fact, I think part of it is that these writings are revealing what is a deeper concern of populism, though this idea about socialism on the basis of the commune was certainly part of it. Not, in other words, the defense of the common people or championing of the commune, though this is certainly important. What really is, I think, at the heart of populism, as you look at these writings and listen to populists at the time, was something deeper, a somewhat familiar moral vision, even an obsession with creating a moral society, a just society. In fact, I would define populism first and foremost as a moral philosophy. And as you can see, the sort of attempt to wrap this in scientific terms, such as existed in the 1860s, was pretty much gone. Now, as I've said, more than earlier dissenting movements, the thing that also really distinguished the populists of the 1870s was that this was a philosophy that demanded action. There was, as I said, a moral duty of critical thinking individuals to act, especially in relationship to the common people to whom they owed a moral debt. So the populists began to do something new, to really go in large numbers among the common people of Russia. They began to organize libraries in villages and in urban areas for workers. They began to give lectures, to run various discussion circles, often attracting urban workers who were only peasants only a few years before, so they felt they were in touch with the countryside, even among those new workers in the cities. Typical curriculum, whether it was in the city or in those few cases where they went into the country, but few yet did, they taught, for example, natural science. This was important. Science would undermine religious faith by showing how the world worked. History was always a popular topic because, as they recognized, it's always possible to impose a nice political slant on the stories you tell about the past. They particularly liked to tell about earlier rebellions in Russian history. Pugachev's rebellion and its heroism and its goals were a very important part of the lessons they taught in these schools. And, of course, writings by socialists, European socialists, Russian socialists, Belinsky, Herzen, others. In 1874, this movement reached a new stage, an unprecedented stage. In the late spring and summer of 1874, thousands of young people left the cities to, as they called it, go to the people. No one knows the exact total number of people who participated in this movement. We do know that 1,600 of them were arrested by summer's end, and this was only a minority. Many of them dressed as peasants or itinerant craftsmen, or one should say at least how they thought peasants or itinerant craftsmen dressed, which was generally rather badly, and they sought to contact peasants in absolutely any way they could. Many of them had never met a peasant before, or at best they were out there in the distance working on their family estates. The message they carried to the peasants was rather simple. All the land should belong to the people. The very same thing peasants called the black repartition, all the land distributed. The economy, they said, should be organized collectively, whether it was rurally or urban factories. And everyone, they said, should be free and equal in society, in wealth, before the law. Sometimes they would try to argue these views directly to peasants. They'd simply try to walk into a peasant house and say, I'd like to talk to you about politics, about the church being backward, about the landlord being evil, about the czar. Many decided this was a little risky and took a more indirect approach. For example, they would translate their ideas into religious terms. They would quote from the Gospels, or they liked to tell stories about how Christ, a carpenter, not a member of the elite, was portrayed. They would tell how Christ was a spiritual father of all revolutionaries. And they also liked to make up little peasant folktales, or in the style of folktales, that ended with certain messages. The rich are exploiters. The state has there's no need for it. And everybody has to live as equals. Peasants responded to this in a rather mixed way. There were some positive responses from peasants. After all, in a certain sense, they agreed, at least with the argument that they needed all the land and should be left alone by the state. Sometimes, though, peasant willingness to agree with these people turned out to be rather deceptive. For example, a peasant might invite this student pretending to look like a peasant. They knew perfectly well they weren't. They didn't even talk like peasants. Into their home, they might sit down, say, oh, thank you for this pamphlet. Very nice. And even say he would read it, but of course he couldn't because he was generally literate. It was considered polite. One didn't want to be rude. Besides, peasants discovered quickly that these pamphlets made very good cigarette paper. Most often, though, peasants simply listened politely to what the students had to say and showed no interest whatsoever. And a few even showed open hostility, especially when these students began to criticize the church or the czar, and even turned some of these students over to the local police, or even beat them up. Overall, then, especially in relationship to expectations, this movement was a failure. Peasants refused to believe criticisms against the Tsar. True, the landlords were devils. The priests were even devils. But the Tsar would soon take care of them and give them all the land. Tsar Father would take care of them. Student radicals also found, even more troubling to many of them, problems with what they described as peasant fatalism, as peasant submissiveness. In fact, some peasants even tried to explain this to these propagandists. As one peasant put it to one of these students, peasants had to endure hardship, offense, and foul treatment because they were, as this peasant put it, drunkards to a man or had forgotten God. In other words, they were themselves to blame for their sufferings. Now, in the wake of this summer, which was known as the Mad Summer by some of 1874, populists were a little confused and uncertain over what to do next. And gradually, two answers began to emerge, creating actually a split. First, these answers were debated within an organization that had been formed in 1876 called Land and Liberty, but gradually it led to a split into two organizations following these two strategies as to what to do. One answer, more education. Peasants are backward. One needs to organize more schools. One needs to help them understand what needs to be done in Russia. And this organization, the organization that advocated this, which was formed finally in 1879, called itself Black Repartition, this term peasants like to use, Chorny Peredel in Russian. Another group, also forming a separate party in 1879 that called itself People's Will, Narodnaya Volya, favored what it called propaganda of the deed, which is to say, terror. Now, terror, it's worth saying, was very popular. In fact, People's Will attracted far more members than Black Repartition. And it even attracted some surprising sympathy from liberals in Russian society, especially when truly hated reactionary officials were killed. This parting of the ways was getting greater and greater between the educated and the state, as the popularity of terrorism suggests. Now, historians have tried in various ways to explain why terror was so popular. One answer is it was simply satisfying. It actually accomplished something, unlike everything else radicals and even liberals have been trying to do. And indeed, it had many results. Many officials, as I indicated, were killed, and in 1881, the Tsar himself. It also was said to be a reflection of a faith, a false one, that the peasants were ready to rebel. They just needed to be inspired. And in particular, they needed to be shown that the state was not invulnerable, that in fact, people could be killed, damage could be done, and this would inspire peasants to act. And others have argued, at heart, terrorism was a reaction, a response in kind to government violence against people, against radicals, against others. Terrorists themselves, in fact, testified to all these reasons. But their statements also indicate something more deeply rooted, what might be described as personal, even moral motives. Let me just quote, without editorial comment, a couple of the testimonies by terrorists themselves. For example, Vera Zasulich, a 29-year-old woman from a noble family who shot the governor general of St. Petersburg right in his office, claimed she did it to avenge the beating by the governor general of a political prisoner who she personally knew. She said, "I resolved at that point, even if it cost my life, to prove that no one who abused a human being would be able to get away with it." Interestingly enough, she went before a jury, made just this plea, and the jury acquitted her. It was true. Police shouldn't be allowed to behave this way. Clearly, this was more than a marginal phenomena. There was a sense of the justifiability of acting against the state in this way. Other examples are similar. The man who stabbed to death the chief of gendarmes, a man named Sergei Kravchinsky, in 1878, he argued that he had to do it because the chief thought he was above the law. He trampled on the human dignity of others, and he noted he didn't stab him in the back, he stabbed him in the front. This was a moral act. Now, you can interpret these statements in different ways, but I want to at least ask, is it too far-fetched to suggest that terror, at least in the minds of terrorists then, was seen as an ethical act, that murder even expressed a peculiar understanding, but still a type of morality. Now, by the mid-1880s and the early 1890s, many educated Russians began to worry that none of this was getting them anywhere. And as a result, increasing numbers began to declare themselves to be not populists anymore, but Marxists. This began first among the leaders of the populist movement, almost all of whom were in European exile, where a number of leading populist intellectuals sitting in Geneva or London declared themselves to now be the followers of the ideas of Karl Marx. And back in Russia, similarly, a number of populist study circles where students and workers and others met declared themselves also to be Marxists. In 1895, two of these circles, both led by students, among them the future communist leader Vladimir Lenin and his chief opponent, Yuli Martov, formed an organization called the Petersburg Union of Struggle for the Emancipation of the Working Class. And most interestingly, they announced a new strategy. Before, their strategy was propaganda, unless it was terrorism, which meant sharing books with workers, talking about big ideas. They decided this was inadequate, and of course terrorism was counterproductive, and they proposed a new strategy they called agitation. This meant going right to the factories where workers worked, handing out leaflets, and talking to them not about big philosophical ideas, but about their everyday hardships and the need to protest. This strategy, of course, brought them the attention of workers as never before, especially as this was a time when workers themselves were beginning to organize and strike against conditions. But it also brought these young Marxists to the attention of the police. By the start of 1896, in other words, within less than a year of the forming of the Union of Struggle, all of its members were in jail and soon in Siberia. A couple years later, in 1898, the Marxists who were still free and encouraged by those in European exile secretly gathered in the town of Minsk and established a party that they called the Russian Social Democratic Workers' Party. This was the first Congress, but it came to nothing because within a few weeks, everybody present at the conference had been arrested. Then in 1900, Martov and Lenin and other members of the St. Petersburg Union of Struggle completed their sentences and decided to rebuild the party. They left to Western Europe. There was no point in trying in Russia. They couldn't do anything with the power of the police. And they founded a newspaper, which they called The Spark, or Iskra in Russian, and built a network of circles in various cities to read and distribute this paper. Now, the real question that has to be asked is, why did Marxism, which would become so fateful for the future of Russia, especially in the 20th century, have such an appeal at this point? And to understand this, one has to recognize that there was what might be described as a real intellectual political crisis in the minds of young intelligentsia, in particular of these young socialists who were called populists. And the problem was reconciling their faith, their ideals, with reality. Quite simply, all the promises of populism, that socialism was coming, seemed less and less believable, plausible, by the 1890s, though they loved the ideals nonetheless. For example, populism taught that Russia could avoid the evils of capitalism. And yet everywhere there were signs that capitalism was rising in Russia, especially by the 1890s, a period of increasing urbanization and industrialization. Industries are growing. The peasantry is becoming more differentiated between richer and poorer. And peasants are migrating to the city. Everything populism believed in was beginning to disintegrate, including the very commune that was to be its basis as its members took off to the city. Populism also taught, of course, that peasants were naturally revolutionary. It was the whole point of the education. It wouldn't need too much, and especially the point of terrorism. Yet there were absolutely no signs that peasants were radical. In fact, this was one of the quietest periods in peasant life. In fact, every effort of these radicals seemed to, at best, be responded to with passivity, and at worst, with growing alienation and hostility to what these radicals were doing. On top of this, of course, the government had totally destroyed much of the populist movement, and most of its revolutionaries were in prison or exile. A terribly depressing time. And then shows up Marxist ideas. This gave them a sort of hope, a solution to this crisis. First of all, it told them that capitalism was a terrible thing morally, But historically, now they finally understand what Marx was saying, historically it was actually a good thing. It was even a virtue. At least it turned this necessity into virtue. According, of course, to the Marxist historical dialectic, which theorizes about how contradictory things produce progress, capitalism was necessary to socialism. Economically, it would build up the nation's productive resources, creating the economic preconditions for socialism. Politically, it would bring about freedom and democracy as the bourgeoisie, the class most closely connected to the rise of capitalism, would insist on a liberal democratic society, which would give workers a better opportunity to organize and build their movement. And culturally, it was said by Marxists that capitalism would build up the level of education. One needed skilled workers. One needed a degree of literacy. And therefore, rational and scientific thinking, which was also part of the capitalist idea, would become the norm. All the preconditions would be laid, and then the system would be racked by crises, because Marx insisted this was so, and the system would collapse. And the socialists would be able to build their new society. This was a lot better than the populist promise, none of which seemed plausible. At least this gave them hope. Secondly, Marxism gave hope to these radicals looking for some way to change their country in a dramatic way by pointing to a different revolutionary class. Rather than talking about peasants, who seemed very disappointing, it talked about workers, or as Marxists like to call them, the proletariat. And the fact that there really was an emerging labor movement in Russia, developing quite spontaneously in the 1870s and the 80s, and especially in the 90s, seemed to bear out Karl Marx's promise that, in Marx's rather colorful phrase, capitalism would give birth to its own grave diggers. That workers, in other words, rather than those terribly disappointing peasants, would lead Russia to socialism. Now, as you can see, there's a sort of deterministic logic to Marxism. Capitalism is inevitable. So was the bourgeois democratic revolution. And then would come the socialist revolution, once capitalism wore out and the proletariat was educated and organized and ready. In other words, it told them that history, however bad it seemed to be looking to them, was actually on their side. This gave them great hope and attracted many to this movement. But it also implied that you can't rush history, that you have to go through these stages. First capitalism, then the bourgeois revolution, then you'd have the socialist revolution. Many Marxists liked this. They found it encouraging. They found that it comforting. But some Marxists, especially in Russia, found this determinism to be too constraining. It wasn't revolutionary enough. It didn't have an agenda for action. And among those who were dissatisfied by this determinism of Marxism included Lenin, who's the subject of the next lecture, along with his greatest opponent within the Russian Marxist movement, Yuli Martov.
Lecture 16, Paths to Revolution, Lenin and Martov.
In the year 1903, took place in Russia what might seem like a really minor, in fact quite trivial, event, but which turned out to have important, even one might say world-shaking historical significance. The Russian Social Democratic Party, which sought to unite all Marxists and was basically wiped out after its first Congress anyway, now was able to hold a second Congress. And this meeting actually couldn't take place in Russia at all, though it involved Russians. It had to take place in Western Europe to avoid the sort of arrests that decimated the party after the first Congress. But even in Europe, they found they had problems. The meeting first started in Brussels, ran into problems with the police, who were warned by the Russian government not to allow these radicals to organize, and then it went off and moved to London, where it finally finished its work. Well, lots of different groups and factions had come together to reestablish the party at its second Congress, and they argued vehemently over all sorts of important issues, not least of which was the question of what their relationship would be to terrorism, still so popular in Russia at the time. They decided terrorism to a Marxist was unacceptable, not because it was immoral, but because it was simply counterproductive. But the issue that actually most divided them, and which led to a permanent split in the party, and in which had the most significant long-term repercussions, was over a seemingly minor issue, indeed a quite boring question of membership. Who could be a member of the Socialist Party? Two former comrades from the Petersburg Union of Struggle led each side of the argument. On the one side was a man whose true name was Vladimir Ulyanov, a 33-year-old former law student, now a full-time revolutionary, who went by the name of Lenin. His goal was to limit party membership to people, in his phrase, who personally participated in one of the party organizations. On the other side of the argument was a man named Yuli Cederbaum, a man who was 3 years younger than Lenin, also, though, a full-time revolutionary, who went by the party name of Martov. He preferred a more open definition of the party, of a party member, to anybody, in his phrase, who would render the party regular personal assistance under the guidance of one of its organizations. This may seem like a tiny difference, but essential principles were at stake. And in fact, this lecture will look at these two men and the differences, often quite deep, that divided them, and the consequences, which was nothing less than the emergence of Russian communism. Now, Lenin tried to explain what divided them in a comment he made to the Congress. He said, the trouble with Martov's formula is that it extended party membership, whereas his goal was to narrow party membership. And he made it quite clear why he opposed, even feared, Martov's proposal to extend party membership. In his rather colorful phrases, Lenin was always known as a great speaker. Martov's formula would allow, as Lenin put it, mud and slime to ooze into the party. It would open the party doors, he told the Congress, to waverers and babblers and opportunists. Russia couldn't afford such party leaders when such important tasks lay ahead. And now I think we're getting a little closer to the differences in listening to these words by Lenin. Concretely, in fact, the differences were quite clear. Lenin wanted a party that included only full-time revolutionaries. That's what he meant by narrowing the definition of a party member. An elite, in other words, a vanguard, as he liked to call them, that would follow strict party discipline. Martov had in mind a more open party, a mass party, a democratic party, though to be sure, it would have to have a conspiratorial leadership. Given conditions in Russia, only a secret cell of leaders would not be subject to arrest. But the party as a whole should be much more open. Now, interestingly enough, when this issue was brought to a vote, Lenin lost. However, a little bit later in the debates, he held a slight majority when electing the party leaders, as well as the editorial board of the party's newspaper, Iskra, the Spark, which was printed in Western Europe and distributed in Russia. As a result of this victory, though he lost an earlier important vote, he decided to call his faction the Bolsheviks, which is from the Russian word for the majority, for the people in the majority. And Lenin's Martov's group was left, therefore, to call itself, by logic, the Mensheviks, the minority, the group of the minority. And though, in fact, Lenin would soon be a minority within the party in terms of a number of party members actually there, Lenin wisely continued to use the term Bolshevik for his even small faction, leaving Mensheviks stuck with that name. Most important, though, Lenin worked to make his faction, his Bolshevik faction, a disciplined professional party, even if that's not what the party rules as a whole required. And after 1917, of course, this Bolshevik party would become the ruling Communist Party and would apply similar principles about leadership and discipline to ruling Russia, what became the Soviet Union, as a whole. Now, it's well worth, I think, looking at some of the underlying differences dividing Mensheviks and Bolsheviks. And needless to say, the reason for understanding Lenin and Bolshevism is quite obvious. Their ideas helped shape 74 years of Russian history. But it's also worth remembering and taking seriously the arguments of those that history initially swept aside, partly because their ideas haven't been totally forgotten, but perhaps most importantly, as reminding us that Russian life, even Russian radicalism, contained still very important alternative visions, very different paths and conceptions of Russia's future and fate, even among those who embrace the same important Marxist ideology. And to understand these differences, I'll focus mostly on two individuals, on Lenin, the leader of the Bolsheviks, and Martov, the leader of the Menshevik. And I'll say something about their personalities, their political personalities, but also I want to focus on their ideas about their approaches to two really key ideas for both of them, democracy and what was called consciousness. Now, in a lot of ways, Yuli Martov, Sederbaum, his real name, who lived from 1873 until 1923, fits rather well into the whole tradition of the Russian intelligentsia that we've been talking about, reaching back to Novikov and the Decembrists and Belinsky and Herzen, and in fact forward, as you'll see later, to the Soviet dissidents. Above all, Martov was driven by a moral passion for justice. And this may have been partly shaped by his own youthful experience growing up as a Jew in southern Russia, in the city of Odessa, in the 1870s and 1880s. These were absolutely horrible times to be Jewish in Russia. Times of intense and increasing discrimination in education, in employment, in where one could live, and even time of periodic violence against Jews, anti-Semitic riots that were known as pogroms, and in particular, an enormous outbreak of these terribly violent attacks on Jews in cities and towns throughout especially southern Russia that broke out in 1881, just after the assassination of Alexander II. This was when Martov was 8, and he witnessed one of these terrible pogroms in Odessa. These experiences of being a Jew in Russia in the late 19th century led many Russian Jews either to the rising movement of Zionism, the idea that the only help would be to leave Russia for Palestine or somewhere else. It also led many to Jewish socialism, a socialist party formed, known as the Bund, that focused on the same basic goals as other Marxists and populists shared, but focusing particularly on improving conditions for Jews and paying particular attention to Jewish needs. But it also led many young and older Jews to liberalism, to populism as a whole, to the socialist, the Marxist movement, to the idea of changing society for everyone and hence making it possible to live as a Jew or any other ethnic minority in Russia. Now, Martov's own parents, who were actually relatively educated and not at all as poor as most Jews were in Russia in this period, responded to all of these conditions, to the plight of Jews, with liberal answers. They believed that the solution to the suffering of the Jews, and indeed to most other problems in Russia, were civil rights, freedom of press and speech and assembly and religion, and a democratic government. Many liberals liked them, and they were of that sort. In high school, Martov began to become obsessed with going further than his parents, began to read a great deal about social and political and moral questions, and since, of course, he found few answers to his concerns in the conservative curriculum that was authorized in the schools, he, of course, sought his answers elsewhere, first with his parents' liberal ideas, but increasingly going beyond them. Indeed, one of his favorite authors in these years, in high school we're talking about, was Vissarion Belinsky, who we know well. Later, in the 1880s, his parents moved to St. Petersburg, something very few Jews were given an opportunity to do. And here he became involved in the student movement and was especially impressed by populists, by their moral courage to stand up to the state, even by terrorism. And in fact, the moment when he was first arrested for minor activities in a student movement was a point of great pride. He recalled later sitting in the carriage with the policeman beside him, going off to jail, and knowing he too was one of those moral heroes to stand up for justice. In time, like